Couple of things it's not that I don't want, that I won't be talking about particularly. I want to mention this because several years ago I was doing a Tolkien thing up here, and one lady was distressed halfway through. She stopped me. She said, "This is not a religious book discussion." I said, "No, ma'am, it's certainly not." She said, "Well, why do you call it The Lord of the Rings?" She thought it was another religious book, and it's not. So she was disappointed with that. So I wanted to put that disclaimer out. If you're looking for a religious book discussion, this ain't it. Okay, got that out of the way. The second thing it's not, and I don't want to disappoint anybody, is not going to be a scholarly exposition of the whole trilogy and tell you what all the allegory is all about and all the hidden things you've always wanted to know about that, because I don't know anything about that. So there's the second one. If I haven't lost anybody yet, maybe we're okay. I've always felt that the trilogy was, just as Tolkien said, it's a book of adventure that he wrote for his kiddos. That's it. If you find allegory and other kinds of hidden meanings in it, I think that's probably fair game, but I think you've got to go easy on that. I've always gone easy on criticism anyway. Don't like criticism very much. I think it's hard to be a creative artist. It's easier to be a critic. But there obviously is a lot of stuff going on in here. There are wars and battles and good and bad and good and evil and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's fair game. I think any artist only owns part of what he creates. The subconscious is certainly responsible for a lot of stuff. And if Tolkien says, no, there's no allegory in here, I think you should believe him. And then if you're of a mind, you can say, yeah, I believe you, but I think I see this going on. Like the guy with Robert Frost, you know, why did you repeat that line? Miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Frost said, because I like the line, the critic never believed him. He said, no, it's death wish, and he went on to prove it. So I don't want to do that. So if you just want to hear about what the books are about, let me get an idea of where you are with these books. I assume you've all read them. These guys have already told me they've read them 15 times each, so they're going to be critics today. Is there anybody that has not read these books? Or part of them. Okay, the rest of you have all been at them for a while or more than once. Okay. Then maybe you'll be the most disappointed if I don't explain things. I was talking about this in University of Nebraska one time years ago, and I said, I was going along and I said, and then Aragorn said this to Tom Bombadil or something, and I noticed a hand in the back. Raised his hand. I said, yeah. And this fellow said, no, it was not. He didn't say it to Tom Bombadil. He said it to Frodo Baggins. I said, oh, that's right, Frodo Baggins, thank you. And I went on again, and I said, then when they crossed the, they met at the Red Pony Inn on his hand. I said, yeah. He said, no, it wasn't the Red Pony, it was the other place. I said, oh, thanks. Well, this went on for about a half hour, and I kept looking at, pretty soon that hand would go up. Finally, I said, who are you? He was just one of my freshman students. I said, you must know this book. He said, yeah, I do. I said, how many times have you read it? He said, 18 times. 18? I was the prof. I felt a little abashed. So I called him up here, and we both sat on the edge of the desk, and we team taught the university English class together, the freshman and I. And every time I'd make a point, I'd look over him. I'd say, have I got this right now? And he would set me straight. You see, this is an epic. And anytime you're dealing with an epic, you got lots of folks. There are a lot of characters. This book is longer than War and Peace. It's every bit as involved as any Russian novel. It's got characters, subplots, and all that. So if you get lost a few times, you can forgive yourself. It's not only is longer than War and Peace, it's got more language than War and Peace. After all, he does invent languages, doesn't he? Elvish, Orcish, and all that kind of stuff. The common speech and all that. He creates a history. He creates characters who have histories, and then he has footnotes in the back, the appendix. You could spend a career, I suppose, being a scholar on the appendix, for crying out loud. And if you're crazy about those kinds of things, you can prove or disprove anything in Tolkien by going to the appendix. And I've known students, years ago, there used to be Tolkien societies around. There still are, but they're not as numerous. I was shocked a year ago when I met my class, and I said, we're going to talk about Tolkien. And not one of my freshmen that semester had ever read Tolkien. 10 years ago, it was such a cult that everybody was reading Tolkien, that sort of thing. So it has its moments, I guess. I guess I'm pretty much convinced that The Lord of the Rings is, they are among the top books in literature anywhere. I would put them, if I had to be on the old shipwrecked island, you know, I've put them in there with the Bible and Shakespeare and some Bach and Mozart and the Russian novels. I wouldn't leave Tolkien out. I think this work is going to last forever. It's got everything literature should have. I guess I don't have to tell you this if you've read it. But I'm not. It sounds like I'm trying to convince somebody to read it. Maybe I am. It's got adventure. It's got language. If you like language, you got to like this book. This has Tolkien goes crazy with language. He was an Oxford Don, as you probably know, in languages, Icelandic and about a million other different languages. So he was at home naming things, which is kind of neat. You know, a railroad creek is a nice name. Tolkien probably would have given it six other names. A name that the orcs called it, a name that the elves called it, a name that people called it, a name that the hobbits called it. He loved names, and the names are always just right in Tolkien. When you read of a mountain, the Misty Mountains, you know exactly, immediately, that that's the best name for those mountains, is the Misty Mountains. Or this wood, or that stream, or that ford, or whatever. So he's very good in that regard. So, with that sort of by way of introduction, let me just say a couple of things about the kind of literature it is. Obviously, it's quest literature, you know. And the quest literature, I think, is the greatest literature of all. That's where all the adventure is. The Iliad and the Odyssey is quest literature. And there's some elements that maybe we just spend a second going over that you maybe haven't thought of for a while. What do you have to have in a quest? You have to have a hero. You got to have a hero, otherwise, what good is a quest? In your epics, Jason, the Golden Fleece, Odysseus, great epic hero. So that you have all those kinds of things, that genre of literature. Then you have folk epic. That's what this is. It's a folk / fantasy epic. But I would put the emphasis on the folk rather than fantasy. The minute you say fantasy, it sounds like you're dealing with sort of ephemeral kinds of things. The little people running around. Well, there are little people running around. There are also big people. There are people flying around, and orcs, and all kinds of ugly folk in this. So it's not just a little ephemeral kind of thing, but it's a folk epic. And you have a hero. Now, in the big people's heroes, they're like Odysseus. They're strong, they're macho, they're burly sort of folks. The hero in here, you know who that is, Frodo, is the least hero you'd expect. A little bitty guy. And it's entrusted to him to go on this great epic journey and do what people can't do. So it's like everybody lining up at muster in the Army or in the Navy, and they say, now we need a volunteer. And if you've been around more than a month, everybody takes a step backwards, you know, that old gag. And they got one guy who hasn't learned to do that, so he says, yeah, thank you. And he hasn't moved, really, but everybody else has gone backwards. That's what happens in this book. Gandalf the Wizard comes, for those of you who haven't read the book, I don't want to spoil it for you by saying too much, but the plot is, essentially, that there's evil abroad in the land. That's pretty much it. Sounds like 1984. There's evil abroad in the land, and there's a wizard named Gandalf, who dresses in a funny-looking hat and cape and carries a wand, has an irascible temper. He's probably Irish. And he has come to the Shire, which is the village, like Holden. In fact, I have some super slides that it did not occur to me. I brought them up, and I forgot to arrange. If any of you are going to be around next week, I'll do the same thing again at the Village Center, this time with slides, because I have slides I brought back at great expense and danger from this land. You may recognize Holden in them, but that's, you know, if you want to see the miner's village and the tailings, I guess you can see that, but really they're from the book. And I have some super shots of the marriage of Arwen Evenstar with Aragorn. You won't believe. I remember when I first read this and I came across that name, Arwen Evenstar. I fell in love right there with that name. I thought, if I ever meet a girl named Arwen Evenstar. Arwen. I haven't met him yet. Super name, though. So you've got Frodo, who is the hero, and Gandalf tells Frodo that there's bad things in the land and we've got to make it right. And we need a hero. We need somebody who can set things right because the land is going to waste because the evil force, Sauron, who has a long history, is back. And he has created certain rings at one point, and these rings have magical powers. And when he was through crafting these rings, he made one ring for himself, and when he wears that, or his henchmen wear that, he can control the other rings and all that sort of thing. Frodo, of course, is listening to this, eating his hamburger, and saying, what's that got to do with me? Because if one thing hobbits don't like, it's adventure. Remember that? They would just soon sit in the front of the lodge, eat five meals a day, smoke some pipe weed, have a little beer once in a while, and say, how do the folks going down to the ice cream store on summer nights? The last thing they want to do is have an adventure. In fact, for a hobbit, it was scandalous to go on an adventure. If you've read The Hobbit, you remember Bilbo was looked upon with some askance because he went on adventures. He also came back rich. And Frodo, his nephew, is rumored to be like him because he wants to go on adventure. So he goes on this adventure. When you have an epic, it's to go get something, like Jason the Golden Fleece, or bring something back. In this epic, Tolkien turns around and we've got to take something away. In this case, the ring. The one ring has to be destroyed. Obviously, you can't just drop it in Railroad Creek. That was tried. And the whole Gollum, that whole thing, that ring surfaced. You've got to take it back to where the ring was forged. And you remember that was in Mount Doom, a certain volcano. You've got to take it to Mount St. Helens. You've got to walk up the lava flow, and you've got to drop that sucker right down in there. And then it's destroyed, and the evil passes from the land. Okay, if you see allegory in that, of good and evil, I guess you don't have to look too far. Yeah, it is allegorical, obviously. It's like every man. It's like Pilgrim's Progress. All allegories are the same. Tolkien says this is no allegory. Believe him or not, it's up to you. So you have a hero. Second thing in an epic, you have to have a long journey with an unknown destination. All the epics are that way. You set out on the road, but where that road's going to take you, you're never quite sure. It's enough that you know you have to set out. If you see an allegory there in the Christian life, so be it. Another thing in these folk epics, you have help from animals. That's the fairy tale part of it. If you're the good people, the animals help you. If you're a bad guy, they may not help you. They may trip you up. They may seem to help, but they don't like you instinctively. After all, animals know good from bad right away, don't you? In an epic, you have good versus evil. And you certainly have that in this book, don't you? You have Sauron on one side, and you have Frodo Baggins on the other, and you're never in any doubt, really, of who's good and who's bad. Another point in the epic quest, you have to have an injury to the quester. The person who goes out trying to save the world has got to be hurt. This can be a physical injury, it can be an injury to the psyche, to the spirit, whatever, but the injury has to be such that the quester, if he succeeds, cannot come back and claim what he has saved. It's Thomas Wolfe all over again. You can't go home again. Frodo, in the end, comes back to the Shire. Those of you who remember the book. And the Shire is cleansed, and we all live happily ever after. But not Frodo. Frodo stands there with a tear welling up in his eye and says, I've done all this. I've made it safe for people and for succeeding generations. And good old Sam can become mayor for 16,000 years. And all his offspring can become mayor. But Frodo can't enjoy it. So that's an element in the quest. Just like Odysseus. It takes 10 years to get back to Ithaca, but he's never the same. Okay, and then the last element in the quest, you have to have some friends along the way. There have to be some people who will aid you. And in this instance, there are 9 people who start out on the quest. Some are dwarves, there's an elf, there's a couple of people, there's some hobbits, there's a couple of men. And then these 9 people at one point drift off and have to flake off as the quester goes forward, and they drop off one at a time, and they become involved in their own adventures. In this respect, Tolkien is a great deal like Dickens. Dickens did that in most of his novels. He'd have a central core of people and then radiate out from that, and they would all have their radiating spokes. Before you know it, you get lost in Bleak House, and you're 100 pages from the end. You have no idea how he's ever going to bring all this together. And all of a sudden, 50 pages from the end, it all comes together, and you say, oh, that's how it works. And nobody does that better than Dickens. Tolkien does it brilliantly here. Until the end, obviously that makes for good storytelling. Everybody has their own adventure, but then you have the quester. He's out, and he's turning around and saying, this way, men! Men? There aren't any. You know, the final analysis, it's got to be the quester, in this case, Frodo and Sam, going up that last mile of the volcano alone. If you see an allegory in that, in any sort of life, you know, you are at last, we're on our own. Whether we've got sweethearts or lovers or husbands or wives or children or whatever. In the final analysis, it's you and your secret heart against the unknown. I don't care how much help you have. So that's pretty much what this book is about. Now, read a few sections. And then if you want to ask questions and talk, let's do that. Anytime you have an epic, you could just sit here and read anything, and I suppose it would work. But I want to read a couple of descriptive passages here. Okay, how about, how many did you say you have not read this book? Oh, good. All right, this is for you then. The rest of you have read this probably now a million times. This is what hobbits are like.
Right?
Yeah, the Hobbit is the first book, The Hobbit. This is the trilogy, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That's The Fellowship of the Ring and The Return of the King and The Two Towers, or vice versa. So you don't need to read The Hobbit to get into this. In fact, I would think for adults it's better not to. The Hobbit is written in an altogether different style. It's more a children's story, although adults read it all the time. I tried it, read about 20 pages, and was thoroughly put off by it. I picked this up and never looked back. Then I went back and read The Hobbit, and The Hobbit made more sense. I did it fast backwards. Hello? The Hobbit is the first book. This is The Fellowship of the Ring. It's the first book of the trilogy. Yeah. And you don't need to know The Hobbit. In fact, he recaps The Hobbit here anyway. But The Hobbit's fun to read it for its own sake. But I would read this first. I think you'd like it better. Okay. Hobbits. Hobbits are an unobtrusive but very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today. Let me stop there. This is a storytelling technique. Listen to that again. Hobbits are an unobtrusive... You know what that means. They don't get in your way. I'm being teacher here for a point now. I'm not trying to be pedantic. But very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today. That's a storytelling technique. What he's saying is that you don't see as many of them around anymore, do you? That's a technique. That means it's possible that they're still here. Just because you don't see them doesn't mean it's not true. You see what I'm saying? That's a neat technique. He just drops that in very nicely. For they love peace and quiet and good-tilled earth. There's a lot of them in Iowa, probably. A well-ordered and well-farmed countryside was their favorite haunt. They do not and did not understand or like machines more complicated than a forge bellows, a water mill, or a hand loom, though they were skillful with tools. Even in ancient days, they were, as a rule, shy of the big folk, as they call us. And now they avoid us with dismay and are becoming hard to find. See, I told you, they're around the village. But they're like that cinnamon bear. You don't see them as well. They are quick of hearing and sharp-eyed, and though they are inclined to be fat and do not hurry unnecessarily, they are nonetheless nimble and deft in their movements. So there you see some idea of the kind of person we're dealing with here. Now, they dressed in bright colors. Now, you'd think you'd see them if they were right. Being notably fond of yellow and green, but they seldom wore shoes since their feet had tough, leathery soles, and were clad in thick, curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, which was commonly brown. Thus, the only craft they practiced was shoemaking. Their faces were, as a rule, good-natured rather than beautiful, broad, bright-eyed, red-cheeked, with mouths apt to laughter and to eating and drinking. And laugh they did, and eat and drink, often and heartily, being fond of simple jests at all times and of six meals a day when they could get them. They were hospitable and delighted in parties and in presents, which they gave away freely and eagerly accepted. So there's thumbnail's description of the kind of people we're dealing with. They're hard to find, they're small, they got curly feet, leathery soles, they like bright colors, and they like to laugh and eat and drink. And later on you learn they like to smoke pipe weed. So they're not bad folk. We could use a few more hobbits around. They're good people. They like farming and they don't like adventures and they like to sit on their steps. They like to be left alone and they leave everybody else alone. They think that's the way the world ought to be ordered. Of all people to have this mess fall on them, why didn't Sauron come up to New York City and ask, say, Mayor Koch, you got to get rid of evil in the world? Or Los Angeles or Chicago or somewhere, even Seattle, unlikely spot for evil. But not the Shire, not with the little folk, these guys who like six meals a day and they like peace and quiet. Why them? Well, you can make all kinds of things of that, I suppose. Okay. There's a poem that kind of talks about these rings that maybe I ought to take a look at. There were a bunch of rings made, and this kind of tells you about what happened. The three rings, fairest of all, The elf lords hid from him, and his hand never touched them or sullied them. Seven rings the dwarf kings possessed, but three he has recovered, and the others the dragons have consumed. Nine he gave to mortal men, proud and great, and so ensnared them. Long ago they fell under the dominion of the One, and they became ring wraiths, shadows under his great shadow, his most terrible servants. Long ago, it is many a year since the Nine walked abroad, yet who knows? As the shadow grows once more, they too may walk again. But come, we will not speak of such things, even in the morning of the Shire. So with that kind of thing, Tolkien let you know that these rings were made, and these, especially these nine rings, were given the princes and kings of the earth, very important people, and the minute they put them on, the power went to their head, and they became serfs to the one ring. And he says, but we won't talk about these things in the morning of the Shire. Tolkien does that throughout the book. He says, we've got to talk about these serious things. And he talks about it, he says, but let's not talk about it now. He says it, and he unsays it. It would be like, Holden Village is no place to talk about social issues and evil. You say, yes, that's right. And then you say, well, maybe not. Maybe this is the very place where you should discuss those kind of things. So it's one of those things. Tolkien is too good a writer to violate aesthetic distance. He doesn't tell you too much. He lets you think about what's going on here. Okay, so Frodo is off. He's got his A16 pack hitched up, and he's got his good boots on, and he's got the ring, and he says, all right, I'll take this thing, and I'll drop it in the volcano. He says, I'm not a very likely hero, but if I'm the guy that's got to go, I'll do it. So his faithful companion, Sam, who's the gardener outside clipping the hedge and listening, Sam was always sort of nosy, and he heard Gandalf the wizard telling Frodo what's going on. And Gandalf looked out and saw Sam listening, so he reaches out and snatches him and said, yes, would you like me to turn you into a toad? Why are you listening? And Sam says, I've got to go with my master Frodo. So they set out. And before you know it, there are other hobbits join in. You've got this parade going on. Trying to keep it a secret is impossible. Sort of like Holden Village. Okay, so they take off. They found this is an interesting description here. Well, now we're off at last, said Frodo. They shouldered their packs and took up their sticks and walked around the corner to the west side of Bag End. Bag End is the name of their area in the Shire. Goodbye, said Frodo, looking at the dark black blank windows. He waved his hand and in turn, following Bilbo, who was his uncle, if he had known it, hurried after Peregrine, who was another hobbit, down the garden path. They jumped over the low place in the hedge at the bottom and took to the fields, passing into the darkness like a rustle in the grasses. Remember, these guys are little. They just can't jump over the hedge. They have to search around, find a low place, and they kind of hop over there. They're not big people. Tolkien has a great ability to make everything sort of wistful, even when he's talking about the dire things. Passing into the darkness like a rustle in the grasses. It's all very pastoral. Okay, now they're out hiking, and they've been out several hours on the trail. It would be like if you were going to Holden Lake, and you got way up on the switchbacks, and at the last point we could look back and see the tailings and Railroad Creek, and you have some notion of where the village is before you make the turn and go into the stand of Douglas Fir, and you're on the way to Holden Lake. After some time, they crossed the water west of Hobbiton by a narrow plank bridge. The stream was there no more than a winding black ribbon, bordered with leaning alder trees. A mile or two further south, they hastily crossed the great road from the Brandywine Bridge. They were now in the Took Land, and bending southeastward, they made for the Green Hill Country. As they began to climb its first slopes, they looked back and saw the lamps in Hobbiton, far off, twinkling in the gentle valley of the water. Soon it disappeared in the folds of the darkened land, and was followed by bywater beside its gray pool. When the light of the last farm was far behind, peeping among the trees, Frodo turned and waved a hand in farewell. I wonder if I shall ever look down into that valley again, he said quietly. There's Tolkien again with that wistfulness. You know Frodo's going to go, you know the adventures he's going to find, but he's always turning around saying, I wonder if this is it. It's the unknown that draws him. In fact, what's the Holden? Anybody know the Holden prayer? I used to know it, but I forgot it. There's a printed somewhere on part of the Holden Prayer. It says, God, lead me into the unknown. I don't know where my path's going to take me, but does that ring a bell? It's maybe it's in the hymn book. I don't know. Anyway, it's the same thing. I suppose nobody's life is certain. You never know where it's going to go the next day. Anyway, he's out. Now, listen to the language. Remember I said Tolkien is a master at naming things. When they had walked for about 3 hours, they rested. The night was clear, cool, and starry, but smoke-like wisps of mist were creeping up the hillsides from the streams and deep meadows. Thin-clad birches, swaying in a light wind above their heads, made a black net against the pale sky. They ate a very frugal supper for hobbits, and then went on again. Now hear the names. Soon they struck a narrow road that went rolling up and down, fading gray into the darkness ahead. The road to Woodhall and Stock and the Buckleberry Ferry. They climbed away from the main road in the water valley and wound over the skirts of the green hills towards Woody End, a wild corner of the East Farthing. So in three sentences, he's got about 10 names of things. He's always doing this. You feel like you know, it's very concrete, in other words. If there's anybody that wants to write or be a writer, I teach creative writing. I have them read Tolkien, among other things. If you want to be universal, you better be concrete. You can't work it the other way around. I have a lot of students come to me and say, let me tell you how I feel about the universe. Well, I don't have time for that because I've got to eat the first setting, or I've got a dish team, or I've got to go home and cut the grass, or whatever you've got to do. I say to these students, tell me what you did today, for crying out loud. Can you describe the last hour in some detail? If you can do make language work for you concretely, I'll know all I need to know about you as a universal person. You see what I'm saying? He was very concrete in this. As a result, this thing transcends the concrete and becomes universal. I don't know of any writers who work the other way around. It just doesn't work that way. But a lot of young writers try to start that way. Get in some big trouble. Okay, the black writers. Somehow, as always seems to happen, the evil spirit force knows that the hobbits are on the road with the ring. And Sauron, the evil guy, he's got to get the ring back, remember that one. So he sends these guys out on the black ponies, say, get that hobbit and bring that ring back. It wouldn't be any fun without that. Okay, so they see this guy coming. Right in the middle of this, Tolkien says, I can hear a pony or a horse coming down the road behind, said Sam. They look back, but the turn of the road prevented them from seeing far. Now there's another, just a small literary technique. A hack or a second-rate writer would have had you see exactly what was coming down the road. But here he says he couldn't see anything. That's an interesting technique. All right, so they jump in the bushes. The other two ran quickly to the left and down into a little hollow not far from the road. There they lay flat. Frodo hesitated for a second. Curiosity or some other feeling was struggling with his desire to hide. The sound of hooves drew nearer. Just in time, he threw himself down in a patch of long grass behind a tree that overshadowed the road. Then he lifted his head and peered cautiously above one of the great roots. Round the corner came a black horse. No hobbit pony, but a full-sized horse. And on it sat a large man, who seemed to crouch in the saddle, wrapped in a great black cloak and hood, so that only his boots and the high stirrups showed below. His face was shadowed and invisible. When it reached the tree and was level with Frodo, the horse stopped. The riding figure sat quite still with its head bowed, as if listening. From inside the hood came a noise as of someone sniffing to catch an elusive scent. The head turned from side to side of the road. A sudden, unreasoning fear of discovery laid hold of Frodo, and he thought of the ring. He had hardly dared to breathe, and yet the desire to get it out of his pocket became so strong that he began slowly to move his hand. The advice of Gandalf seemed absurd. Frodo had used the ring, and I am still in the Shire, he thought, as his hand touched the chain on which it hung. At that moment, the rider sat up and shook his reins. The horse stepped forward, walking slowly at first, and then breaking into a quick trot. Frodo crawled to the edge of the road and watched the rider until he dwindled into the distance. Now, listen to this. He could not be sure, but it seemed to him that suddenly, before it passed out of sight, the horse turned aside and went into the trees on the right. Another storytelling technique. It'd be nice to have the horse just disappear, but no. Before he gets over the last hill, he turns and goes into the copse of trees on the right. All the more adventure. You know, he's hiding, waiting somewhere down the road. You remember from the story, those of you who haven't read it, the ring renders one invisible. You put on the ring, and you become invisible. And Gandalf said, don't wear the ring. Whatever you do, don't put it on. Well, that kind of advice can only lead to one thing, right? Where's that ring? Especially if the bad guys are about to catch you. So he fumbles for that chain. You don't want to put the ring on it. It renders you invisible to everybody except the Black Riders and evil. Then they see or a sense of you. They sense the aura of you and they can grab you. And also, the more you put on the ring, you tend to become more and more invisible, longer and longer. You begin to lose your identity and physicalness, physicality, such a word. Okay? So there's that great ability of Tolkien to create suspense. The writers going out of sight and hiding again. He does that all through the book. Tolkien's probably second greatest thing, the first one being names of things, would be his sense of imminent danger. I don't know another writer who has that sense of something just over the horizon is going to get you. Even in the nicest of descriptions, you have that feeling. And I think nature is like that, don't you? Especially in a setting like this. Not in broad daylight when it's 95 degrees, but when the sun starts going down, or when it's 9:30 at night and you're walking up towards the bridge. You know, and you hear the deer browsing or a chipmunk. You hope it's a deer browsing. And it's probably a deer browsing. Yeah, you're sure it's a deer browsing. But you look anyway just to make sure. It might be a Black Rider, you know. You never know. Tolkien had, nature is like that, because once it's dark, you're out of your element in somebody else's element, right? You're in nature, and that can be very rough on you. You could fall into the Wayward Creek and drown, for one thing. So Tolkien has that ability to keep you wondering, what is in there? He's very good at that. Okay. Strider. Strider is an interesting character. That's his nickname. His name is Aragorn. And as they go on their journey, they keep picking up these people. And Strider is a man who's a ranger. The rangers are a group of people whose job it is to walk Heart Lake and Cloudy Pass and the tailings and sort of look out for Holden and keep the evil away from the village. You don't see them because they hang out in inns that we don't even know about. But they're out there, luckily for us. And so Frodo is in this inn having a pint of beer, and he notices this guy sitting over in the corner. Suddenly Frodo noticed that a strange-looking, weather-beaten man sitting in the shadows near the wall was also listening intently to the hobbit talk. He had a tall tankard in front of him and was smoking a long-stemmed pipe, curiously carved. Wouldn't you know it? It wouldn't just be a meerschaum, be curiously carved pipe. His legs were stretched out before him, showing high boots of supple leather that fitted him well, but had seen much wear and were now caked with mud. A travel-stained cloak of heavy dark green cloth was drawn close about him, and in spite of the heat of the room, he wore a hood that overshadowed his face, but the gleam of his eyes could be seen as he watched the hobbits. Now that's Strider. But even there, this is a good guy, but Tolkien has that ability to, that imminent danger. You remember in the story, the hobbits get a little out of hand, they slam back one too many paps, and they start talking too much. And they do a little dance and falls off the table and gets very embarrassed. He puts on his ring and vanishes. And because he's made a fool of himself. And then later Strider says, that was a very foolish thing to do, young man, put on that ring, because there are other people in this tavern who are not so friendly as I am. And Frodo says, yes, I know, it was very dumb of me. So then he picks up Strider, and then he picks up Boromir, and all these people start joining at various points along the road until you have the full nine people. You have any questions or anything while I'm just reading along here? Okay, here's Frodo's asking, or Mary and Pippin are his buddies, hobbit buddies, and they're talking to Strider about these Black Riders. Who are these guys? He says, can they see? He asked. And Strider is trying to, or a ranger, or Aragorn is trying to describe. He says, I was too anxious on the hilltop, answered Strider. I was very anxious to find some sign of Gandalf, but it was a mistake for three of us to go up and stand there so long. For the black horses can see, and the riders can use men and other creatures as spies. They themselves do not see the world of light as we do, but our shapes cast shadows in their minds. Boy, is that spooky. That's a brilliant piece of writing, too. Our shapes cast shadows in their minds. That's one of those things you can't articulate. You just accept intuitively or don't bother with it. which only the noon sun destroys, and in the dark they perceive many signs and forms that are hidden from us. Then they are most to be feared, and at all times they smell the blood of living things, desiring and hating it. Senses, too, there are other than sight or smell. We can feel their presence. It troubles our hearts as soon as we came here, and before we saw them, they feel ours more keenly. Also, he added, and his voice sank to a whisper, the ring draws them. The ring, always the ring, or after the ring. Interesting, for all of this imminent danger, Tolkien has a great sense of humor, if you'll kind of go with it. You notice he says his voice sank to a whisper. They're out in the middle of Copper, they're on top of Copper Mountain now, and his voice sinks to a whisper. Why? Well, who could be there around? And the minute you think there's nobody around, he says, ah, here they come. And out of nowhere come the Black Riders. So they're always doing that kind of thing. And they love to sing. This is medieval romance at its best. And they always have these great epic songs they remember. His voice will sink to a whisper at one time, and the very next breath he'll say, I remember, and then he'll stand up there and have this 5-minute oration, this epic poem at the top of his lungs about how it was in the old days. And all the hobbits sit around the little campfire listening to Strider or Boromir or one of the elves sing this song. And just for a minute ago, he was saying, whisper. And now the Black Riders could be in the next county, but they would hear this song. So you've got to get the little humor going on there. You don't want to make too, it's not a funny book, but, okay. Now the guys are up in this little dell in the mountains, and they're on their way. They've got their bear bags hung, and they're getting ready to get in their Four Seasons bag. And all of a sudden, this is a great line. Did you see anything? Asked Frodo, springing to his feet. If it is a come on. Any writer, you got to have somebody as a straight man saying, did you see anything? No, sir, I saw nothing, but I didn't stop to look. I saw something, said Mary, or I thought I did, away westwards where the moonlight was falling off the flats beyond the shadow of the hilltops. I thought there were two or three black shapes. They seemed to be moving this way. Well, you know darn well they're moving this way. What else would they be doing? Now, keep close to the fire with your faces outward, cried Strider. Get some of the longer sticks ready in your hands. Now here are the little hobbits, unprotected. They don't have guns. They don't have M16s or 48s or whatever the current M is. And these guys, they're on the horses that can sense you and smell blood. They've got power of the ring. They've got all this going for them. And Strider says, pick up the longer sticks. It's a great touch. What in the world is a stick going to do? But he says, pick up the sticks. For a breathless time, they sat there, silent and alert, with their backs toward the wood fire, each gazing into the shadows that encircled them. Nothing happened. There was no sound or movement in the night. Frodo stirred, feeling that he must break the silence. He longed to shout out loud. Hush, whispered Strider. What's that? Gasped Pippin at the same moment. Over the lip of the little dell, on the side away from the hill, they felt rather than saw a shadow rise. One shadow, or more than one. They strained their eyes, and the shadows seemed to grow. Soon there could be no doubt. Three or four tall black figures were standing there on the slope, looking down on them. So black were they seemed like black holes in the deep shade behind them. Frodo thought that he heard a faint hiss as of venomous breath and felt a thin, piercing chill. Then the shape slowly advanced. That ought to remind you of a lot of people that are using that technique. Hawthorne in Young Goodman Brown, for example. When Young Goodman Brown goes in the forest, he thinks he sees this, or it seemed as if this happened. Thought and seemed all the time. And you can say, well, it either did or it didn't, but it's a lot of thinking and seeming. It leaves a lot to your imagination. And another technique he's using, notice these black riders, the bad guys, advance to the lip of this hill and then stop and look at them. They just don't come charging down like gangbusters. They stop and look and let the camera pan around. That's great technique. You notice, you remember in horror films, very often it'll be a child's room, and the camera will pan around, and you see the window open with the curtains billowing in, and you instinctively don't like that, even though it's hot outside. You don't like that curtain billowing in. Something could be there. And then the camera will pan around, and it'll focus on the child's toys. Is there anything more malevolent than a Raggedy Ann and Andy by moonlight, just sitting there, that evil grin? And yet by daylight, it's the greatest thing in the world. Well, that's what Tolkien, he's aware of these kinds of things, so he just lets the black writers pause and look, and we look at them in our imagination, and then they slowly advance. There's much more malevolence than that, just coming up and charging right down in there like Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade. All right, terror overcame Pippin and Merry, and they threw themselves flat on the ground. These little hobbits are always doing that. They just flatten right out. They drop their sticks and put their head over and said, "Don't hit me. Don't hit me. I give up." Sam shrank to Frodo's side. Frodo was hardly less terrified than his companions. He was quaking as if he was bitter cold, but his terror was swallowed up in a sudden temptation to put on the ring. The desire to do this laid hold of him, and he could think of nothing else. He did not forget the barrel or the message of Gandalf, but something seemed to be compelling him to disregard all warnings, and he longed to yield, not with the hope of escape or of doing anything, either good or bad. He simply felt he must take the ring and put it on his finger. He could not speak. He felt Sam looking at him, as if he knew that his master was in some great trouble, but he could not turn towards him. He shut his eyes and struggled for a while, but resistance became unbearable, and at last he slowly drew out the chain and slipped the ring on the forefinger of his left hand. Immediately, though everything else remained as before, dim and dark, the shapes became terribly clear. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. There were five tall figures, two standing on the lip of the dell, three advancing. In their white faces burned keen and merciless eyes. Under their mantles were long gray robes. Upon their gray hairs were helmets of silver. In their haggard hands were swords of steel. Their eyes fell on him and pierced him. As they rushed towards him, desperate, he drew his own sword, and it seemed to him that it flickered red as if it was a firebrand. Two of the figures halted. The third was taller than the others. His hair was long and gleaming, and on his helmet was a crown. In one hand he held a long sword, and in the other a knife. Both the knife and the hand that held it glowed with a pale light. He sprang forward and bore down on Frodo. At that moment, Frodo threw himself forward on the ground, and he heard himself crying aloud, "O Elbereth the Thoniel," which is Elvish. At the same time, he struck at the feet of the enemy. A shrill cry rang out in the night, and he felt a pain like a dart of poisoned ice pierce his left shoulder. Even as he swooned, he caught, as though a swirling mist, a glimpse of Strider leaping out of the darkness with a flaming brand of wood in either hand. With a last effort, dropping his sword, Frodo slipped the ring from his finger and closed his right hand tight upon it. So at that point, Frodo, of course, gives in to the temptation, slips it on, and he throws himself on the ground, and in kind of a meager effort, reaches out and probably stabs the bad guy in the foot as best he could do, and he receives this wound in the shoulder. It's a neat thing that happens after this, because Strider has somehow banished the bad guys, and Frodo has this deep, cold wound that stays with him all his life. So there's his wound, the physical wound. And then the psychical wound is having to face evil for so long that his heart has somehow been damaged. That's his other spiritual wound. But it's interesting that in true storytelling technique, Strider says there's only one thing that'll heal this wound. It's a certain herb that I know about. And I go, I think there's some around here. And I hear they are on top of Copper Mountain. And there's only one herb. And it's at night. And he goes out and comes back with it. You have to admire a guy that can do that. And the lore of this man is extraordinary. You also have to, as Coleridge said, sort of willing suspension of disbelief. And say, well, of course he could find it. He should be able to find it. And it helps. Okay. Do you have any questions or anything now? Comments?
A comment on the style as you were reading out loud, and I thought of it before, and that it really, the style is reminiscent of the King James Bible,
yep.
English, maybe more like 18th century, but just that really lends an air of mystery or high epic.
It absolutely does. You're absolutely right about that. I'm always reminded of bits of the Bible in this.
The cadence.
The powerful words. Also Whitman, Song of Myself, parts of Moby Dick. Every now and then a writer comes along who uses language like a freight train. Yeah, you're right. Good point. Okay. Anything else you want to say? I'll read a couple more sections, then we can... Yeah.
I think it's interesting. Tolkien writing creatively, he really emphasized the importance of, if you're going to create a world, make sure that world follows the rules.
Yep.
but he really does that.
Yeah, he does. It's not a fantasy. That's why it's not a fantasy in that regard. If a good guy falls off a cliff, he's going to get killed. Unless, of course, an eagle happens to catch him. That's possible. The Hobbit, that happens a bunch.
Yeah.
Not so much in The Lord of the Rings, but he creates a world. It's a different world, but he sticks the laws within that world. That's right. He doesn't violate those laws. You're right. They get hungry. They suffer. They die. Okay, one more thing I want to share with you of language here that I think is so good. Oh, listen to this. I hadn't even planned to read this. I opened it at random. There is a veiling shadow that some power lays upon the land, and it marches slowly downstream. It is as if the twilight under endless trees were flowing downwards from the hills. I'd read it just for that. That's super language. It's just... raises something. Here's the one I was going to read to you. Now listen to the language in here. The good guys are in Southern California, we call it a barranca. It's bigger. It's a canyon, really, with a lot of stone around it. Helm's Deep. Remember that? The bad guys, the orcs, are advancing up the draw, and they have taken refuge in this fastness with caves behind them, and they've got a big wall, and they're going to have this super battle going on down here. But the language describing it before the battle is worth listening to. At Helm's Gate, before the mouth of the deep, there was a heel of rock thrust outward by the northern cliff. There upon its spur stood high walls of ancient stone, and within them was a lofty tower. Men said that in far-off days of the glory of Gondor, the sea kings had built here this fastness with the hands of giants. The Hornburg it was called, for a trumpet sounded upon the tower, echoed in the deep behind, as if armies long forgotten were issuing to war from caves beneath the hills. A wall, too, the men of old had made from the Hornburg to the southern cliff, barring the entrance to the gorge. Now listen to this. Beneath it, by a wide culvert, the deeping stream passed out. About the feet of the Horn Rock it wound, and flowed then in a gully through the midst of a wide green gorge sloping gently down from Helm's Gate to Helm's Dyke. Thence it fell into the deeping coombe, and out into the Westfold Vale. There in the Hornburg at Helm's Gate, Eckenbrand, master of Westfold, on the borders of the Mark, now dwelt. My gosh, how epic, how medieval. All these names, you feel like, that's right, I remember that, and you don't, of course. But it's the same technique that Edgar Allan Poe used all the time, only in a different way. For example, in the story, whatever the story is, where he says, you will recall I have borne the insults of Fortunato patiently. That's the opening of... The Cask of Amontillado, that's right. Yeah. And you don't know that at all, he's born these insult pages, but he drops you in medias res, right, in the middle of things, in the guts of things. It's a technique that Tolstoy developed better than anybody else probably. Just plunks you right in the middle of a War and Peace, and there you are, at the soiree of Madame Wozzeckaya, and you feel like you've been there all your life. It's a neat technique. Again, young writers or beginning writers have a problem sometimes. They feel like they must lead up to everything and explain everything, and they usually write six volumes before they get to the story. And it's hard to say, never mind that, just plunk us right down there and go. Never mind, we'll catch up. We'll catch up if we can. If we don't, it's probably not worth it anyway. Okay, maybe one last, and just by way of description. Shelob. Got to have something about Shelob. Shelob is a ghastly spider. Remember her? This is a humongous, ghastly, glutchy spider that must be enormous. Lives down in a big, dank, dark den. That's hard to say. And from time to time, the orcs, in order to keep her happy, drop in an orc or two. Just throw one guy off. He's been put on report and all that's doing. They nudge him over the side, and she gobbles him up, and she lets out a big belch, and that's that for a while. But Frodo has been, Gollum is an evil little critter who's sort of a hobbit gone bad, and he has said, he's on the road too. Sam doesn't trust him, would like to do him in, but Frodo says, no, we've got to trust this bird. And Sam says, I can tell you how to get there. You go this way, up this path, pass. Well, up this pass is a hole, and that's where Shelob the big spider is waiting. So here's a description of her, because she sees Frodo coming. Okay, most like a spider she was, but huger than the great hunting beasts, and more terrible than they, which, by the way, you learn about the hunting spiders in The Hobbit. because the evil purpose in her remorseless eyes, those same eyes that he had thought daunted and defeated, there they were, lit with a fell light. F-E-L-L. Tolkien be too much of a lover of language to let a word like fell go. Fell is a great word. Nobody uses it anymore. I throw it in every now and then to my freshmen. They think, it's peculiar, he's saying fell again. It means, terrible, awful, but worse than that. A fell light clustering in her outthrust head. Great horns she had, and behind her short, stock-like neck, this is a great description, was her huge, swollen body. A vast, bloated bag, swaying and sagging between her legs. Its great bulk was black, blotched with livid marks, but the belly underneath was pale and luminous and gave forth a stench. Her legs were bent with great knob joints high above her back and hair that stuck out like steel spines, and at each leg's end there was a claw. Nice, huh? If something like this lived between here and Cloudy Pass, fewer people would know. As soon as she had squeezed her soft, squelching body and his folded limbs out of the upper exit, etc. Anyway, she's after him, and I won't bother telling you how that comes out, because you may want to read it if you haven't read it. So there's the background of the story. It's a folk quest, literary epic with all the traditions. Remember that he was an Oxford Don. He was a literary professor and professor of language. So he has all the genre techniques of the epic in here, but it's a folk epic, and he abides by that. And he goes away, and the ring is destroyed, and he comes back. After all this, I don't know how many, I've forgotten how many miles he has, and the maps are in the book. He comes back only to find Holden Village, or the Shire, raped by the bad guys. They have completely destroyed and laid waste his village. He says, why did I do all this only to come back and find a mess? So now he's got to set that to rights, which they do in their own inimitable style. And then finally he can lay his burden down, take his Celtic pack off and say, no more of that. And now it's time to grow old gracefully, sit by the fire, raise my grandchildren, except he has been wounded, as I said before, and he can't enjoy the fruits of all this. And that's where it gets to be a sad book, that Frodo is not allowed to reap the rewards of that. But it's a great epic, and one that I certainly recommend to you. As I said again, if you're going to be here next week, I'm going to do this again, only this time I'm going to show the slides, which I wish but I couldn't show them in here anyway. But I have some great slides of the Misty Mountains and all that. Any questions or comments? You guys awake? Oh, great, great audience. You guys are wrapped or something.
Have you read the Cimarillion?
I read In and Among It. I've got it, and I was so taken with the narrative that the Cimmerillion is not narrative, and I like narrative, so I put it down after a while. It's probably something I'm going to have to come to grips with.
Yeah, you got to start about the middle.
But yeah, read both ways.
There are parts of it are
yeah, parts of it aren't right.
Some of the chapters, like folklore, some of the figures they talk about, just vaguely. Mm-hmm.
There's no end to stuff once you get into Tolkien. You just read and read and read. The story of how, some of you know the story of how this was written. Now, he wrote it for his kiddos, and then he took it to a publisher and said, and Tolkien's a very retiring sort of guy, and he said, I've got a book I wrote for my kiddos. You probably don't want to read it. And the publisher says, probably not. And Tolkien says, oh, okay. And he took it back home, and the publisher says, send it to me. We're friends. I'll read it. So he did, and meanwhile the publisher went on vacation and left Junior publisher in charge of the shop, and this manuscript arrived, and Junior said, what is this? And didn't know what it was, and took it home and he said, read a few lines to his kids and said, do you like it? And the kids were watching television and said, no, we don't like it. So he sent it back. Tolkien says, it's no good. And Tolkien says, you're probably right. Stuck it in his drawer. And I don't know how many months or years went by before I'd forgotten the story. When he's talking to the publisher, came back again. Publisher said, weren't you telling me sometime about the book you'd written for kiddos, an adventure story? Tolkien says, yeah, but your son turned it down. And he said, oh, Junior again. He says, well, give me the book, we'll see. And the rest is history. Of course, it's been translated into 1,000 languages and it's sold gillions of copies. And it made Tolkien finally, in his later years, a very rich man, and it ruined his life. He had to move out of it because people started coming over and falling into his soup, as Ernie Zorb used to say. He used to be a mountaineer around here. And tramping into his petunias, and he could never get any peace and quiet. So, I guess fame had. Huh? Yeah, it's his wound, yeah. Anything else? All right. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.